It might have been as little as 2 hours later when Jack heard the sound Captain Farron had described as thunder rolling along the earth. Or it might have been as long as 4. Once the sun passed below the western rim of the forest, and it did that not long after Jack had entered it, it became difficult to judge the time. On a number of occasions, vehicles came out of the west, presumably bound for the Queen's Pavilion. Hearing each one come, and vehicles could be heard a long way away here, the clarity with which sound carried made Jack think of what Speedy had said about one man pulling a radish out of the ground and another smelling it a half mile away, made him think of Morgan. And each time he hurried first down into the ditch, and then up the other side, and so into the woods. He didn't like being in these dark woods, not even a little way in, where he could still peer around the trunk of a tree and see the road. It was no rest cure for the nerves. But he liked the idea of Uncle Morgan, for so he still believed Osmond Superior to be, in spite of what Captain Farron had said, catching him out on the road even less. So each time he heard a wagon or carriage approaching, he got out of sight, and each time the vehicle passed, he went back to the road. Once, while he was crossing the damp and weedy right-hand ditch, something ran or slithered over his foot, and Jack cried out. The traffic was a pain in the tail, and it wasn't exactly helping him to make better time. But there was also something comforting about the irregular passage of wagons. They served notice that he wasn't alone, at least. He wanted to get the hell out of the territories altogether. Speedy's magic juice was the worst medicine he'd ever had in his life, but he would gladly have taken a belly-choking swig of it if someone, Speedy himself, for example, had just happened to appear in front of him and assure him that when he opened his eyes again, the first thing he would see would be a set of McDonald's Golden Arches, what his mother called the Great Tits of America. A sense of oppressive danger was growing in him, a feeling that the forest was indeed dangerous, that there were things in it aware of his passage, that perhaps the forest itself was aware of his passage. The trees had gotten closer to the road, hadn't they? Yes. Before, they had stopped at the ditches. Now they infested those as well. Before, the forest had seemed composed solely of pines and spruces. Now other sorts of trees had crept in, some with black boles that twisted together like gnarls of rotted strings, some that looked like weird hybrids of firs and ferns. These latter had nasty-looking gray roots that gripped at the ground like pasty fingers. "Our boy," these nasty things seemed to whisper inside of Jack's head. "Our boy." "All in your mind, Jacko. You're just freaking out a little." Thing was, he didn't really believe that. The trees were changing. That sense of thick oppression in the air, that sense of being watched, was all too real. And he had begun to think that his mind's obsessive return to monstrous thoughts was almost something he was picking up from the forest, as if the trees themselves were sending to him on some horrible short wave. But Speedy's bottle of magic juice was only half full. Somehow that had to last him all the way across the United States. It wouldn't last until he was out in New England if he sipped a little every time he got the willies. His mind also kept returning to the amazing distance he had traveled in his world when he had flipped back from the territories. 150 feet over here had equaled half a mile over there. At that rate, unless the ratio of distance traveled were somehow variable, and Jack recognized that it might be, he could walk 10 miles over here and be damn near out of New Hampshire over there. It was like wearing 7-league boots. Still, the trees, those gray, pasty roots. When it starts to get really dark, when the sky goes from blue to purple, I'm flipping back. That's it. That's all she wrote. I'm not walking through these woods after dark. And if I run out of magic juice in Indiana or something, old Speedy can just send me another bottle by UPS or something. Still thinking these thoughts, and thinking how much better it made him feel to have a plan, even if the plan only encompassed the next 2 hours or so, Jack suddenly realized he could hear another vehicle, and a great many horses. Cocking his head, he stopped in the middle of the road. His eyes widened, and two pictures suddenly unspoiled behind his eyes with shutter-like speed. the big car the two men had been in, the car that had not been a Mercedes, and then the wild child van, speeding down the street and away from Uncle Tommy's corpse, blood dripping from the broken plastic fangs of its grill. He saw the hands on the van's steering wheel, but they weren't hands. They were weird, articulated hooves. At the full gallop, that damned hearse sounds like thunder rolling along the earth. Now, hearing it, the sound still distant but perfectly clear in the pure air, Jack wondered how he could have even thought those other approaching wagons might be Morgan's diligence. He would certainly never make such a mistake again. The sound he heard now was perfectly ominous, thick with a potential for evil. The sound of a hearse, yes, a hearse driven by a devil. He stood frozen in the road, almost hypnotized, as a rabbit is hypnotized by headlights. The sound grew steadily louder, the thunder of the wheels and hooves, the creak of leather rigging. Now he could hear the driver's voice. "Hee-ya! Hee-ya! Hee-ya!" He stood in the road, stood there, his head drumming with horror. "Can't move. Oh, dear God, oh, dear Christ, I can't move. Mom, Mom, Mommy!" He stood in the road, and the eye of his imagination saw a huge black thing like a stagecoach tearing up the road, pulled by black animals that looked more like pumas than horses. He saw black curtains flapping in and out of the coach's windows. He saw the driver standing on the teeterboard, his hair blown back, his eyes as wild and crazed as those of a psycho with a switchblade. He saw it coming toward him, never slowing. He saw it run him down. That broke the paralysis. He ran to the right, skidding down the side of the road, catching his foot under one of those gnarled roots, falling, rolling. His back, relatively quiet for the last couple of hours, flared with fresh pain, and Jack drew his lips back with a grimace. He got to his feet and scurried into the woods, hunched over. He slipped first behind one of the black trees, but the touch of the gnarly trunk, it was a bit like the banyans he had seen while on vacation in Hawaii year before last, was oily and unpleasant. Jack moved to the left and behind the trunk of a pine. The thunder of the coach and its outriders grew steadily louder. At every second, Jack expected the company to flash by toward All Hands Village. Jack's fingers squeezed and relaxed on the pine's gummy back. He bit at his lips. Directly ahead was a narrow but perfectly clear sightline back to the road, a tunnel with sides of leaf and fern and pine needles. And just when Jack had begun to think that Morgan's party would never arrive, a dozen or more mounted soldiers passed, heading east, riding at a gallop. The one in the lead carried a banner, but Jack could not make out its device, nor was he sure he wanted to. Then the diligence flashed across Jack's narrow sightline. The moment of its passage was brief, no more than a second, perhaps less than that, but Jack's recall of it was total. The diligence was a gigantic vehicle, surely a dozen feet high. The trunks and bundles lashed with stout cord to the top added another 3 feet. Each horse in the team which pulled it wore a black plume on its head. These plumes were blown back almost flat in a speed-generated wind. Jack thought later that Morgan must need a new team for every run, because these looked close to the end of their endurance. Foam and blood sprayed back from their working mouths in curds. Their eyes rolled crazily, showing arcs of white. As in his imagining, or his vision, black crepe curtains flew and fluttered through glassless windows. Suddenly a white face appeared in one of those black oblongs, a white face framed in strange, twisting carving work. The sudden appearance of that face was as shocking as the face of a ghost in the ruined window of a haunted house. It was not the face of Morgan Sloat, but it was. And the owner of that face knew that Jack, or some other danger just as hated and just as personal, was out there. Jack saw this in the widening of the eyes and the sudden vicious down-twist of the mouth. Captain Farron had said he'll smell you like a rat, and now Jack thought dismally, I've been smelled all right. He knows I'm here, and what happens now? He'll stop the whole bunch of them, I bet, and send the soldiers into the woods after me. Another band of soldiers, these protecting Morgan's diligence from the rear, swept by. Jack waited, his hands frozen to the bark of the pine, sure that Morgan would call a halt. But no halt came. Soon the heavy thunder of the diligence and its outriders began to fade. His eyes, that's what's the same, those dark eyes and that white face, and... Our boy, yes. Something slithered over his foot and up his ankle. Jack screamed and floundered backward, thinking it must be a snake. But when he looked down, he saw that one of those gray roots had slipped up his foot, and now it ringed his calf. That's impossible, he thought stupidly. Roots don't move. He pulled back sharply, yanking his leg out of the rough gray manacle the root had formed. There was thin pain in his calf, like the pain of a rope burn. He raised his eyes and felt sick fear slip into his heart. He thought he knew now why Morgan had sensed him and gone on anyway. Morgan knew that walking in this forest was like walking into a jungle stream infested with piranhas. Why hadn't Captain Farron warned him? All Jack could think was that the scarred captain must not have known, must never have been this far west. The grayish roots of those fir-fern hybrids were all moving now, rising, falling, scuttling along the mulchy ground toward him. Ents and entwives, Jack thought crazily. Bad ents and entwives. One particularly thick root, its last 6 inches dark with earth and damp, rose and wavered in front of him like a cobra piped up from a faker's basket. Our boy, yes. It darted toward him, and Jack backed away from it, aware that the roots had now formed a living screen between him and the safety of the road. He backed into a tree, and then lurched away from it, screaming as its bark began to ripple and twitch against his back. It was like feeling a muscle which has begun to spasm wildly. Jack looked around and saw one of those black trees with the gnarly trunks. Now the trunk was moving, writhing. Those twisted knots of bark formed something like a dreadful runneled face, one eye widely, blackly open, the other drawn down in a hideous wink. The tree split open lower down with a grinding, rending sound, and whitish-yellow sap began to drool out. Hours, oh yes! Roots like fingers slipped between Jack's upper arm and ribcage as if to tickle. He tore away, holding on to the last of his rationality with a huge act of will, groping in his jerkin for Speedy's bottle. He was aware, faintly, of a series of gigantic ripping sounds. He supposed the trees were tearing themselves right out of the ground. Tolkien had never been like this. He got the bottle by the neck and pulled it out. He scrabbled at the cap, and then one of those gray roots slid easily around his neck. A moment later it pulled as bitterly tight as a hangman's noose. Jack's breath stopped. The bottle tumbled from his fingers as he grappled with the thing that was choking him. He managed to work his fingers under the root. It was not cold and stiff, but warm and limber and flesh-like. He struggled with it, aware of the choked, gargling sound coming from him and the slick of spittle on his chin. With a final, convulsive effort, he tore the root free. It tried to circle his wrist then, and Jack whipped his arm away from it with a cry. He looked down and saw the bottle twisting and bumping away, one of those gray roots coiled about its neck. Jack leaped for it. Roots grabbed his legs, circled them. He fell heavily to the earth, stretching, reaching, the tips of his fingers digging at the thick black forest soil for an extra inch. He touched the bottle's slick green side and seized it. He pulled as hard as he could, dimly aware that the roots were all over his legs now, crisscrossing like bonds, holding him firmly. He spun the cap off the bottle. Another root floated down, cobweb-light, and tried to snatch the bottle away from him. Jack pushed it away and raised the bottle to his lips. That smell of sickish fruit suddenly seemed everywhere, a living membrane. Speedy, please let it work. As more roots slid over his back and around his waist, turning him helplessly this way and that, Jack drank, cheap wine splattering both of his cheeks. He swallowed, groaning, praying, and it was no good, it wasn't working. His eyes were still closed, but he could feel the roots entangling his arms and legs, could feel... The water soaking into his jeans and his shirt. Could smell water? Mud and damp. Could hear jeans, shirt, the steady croak of frogs. And Jack opened his eyes and saw the orange light of the setting sun reflected from a wide river. Unbroken forest grew on the east side of this river. On the western side, the side that he was on, a long field, now partially obscured with evening ground mist, rolled down to the water's edge. The ground here was wet and squelchy. Jack was lying at the edge of the water, in the boggiest area of all. Thick weeds still grew here. The hard frosts that would kill them were still a month or more away. And Jack had gotten entangled in them, the way a man awakening from a nightmare may entangle himself in the bedclothes. He scrambled and stumbled to his feet, wet and slimed with the fragrant mud, the straps of his pack pulling under his arms. He pushed the weedy fragments from his arms and face with horror. He started away from the water, then looked back and saw Speedy's bottle lying in the mud, the cap beside it. Some of the magic juice had either run out or been spilled in his struggle with the malignant territory's trees. Now the bottle was no more than a third full. He stood there a moment, his caked sneakers planted in the oozy muck, looking out at the river. This was his world. This was the good old United States of America. He didn't see the golden arches he had hoped for, or a skyscraper, or an Earth satellite blinking overhead in the darkening sky, but he knew where he was as well as he knew his own name. The question was, had he ever been in that other world at all? He looked around at the unfamiliar river, the likewise unfamiliar countryside, and listened to the distant, mellow mooing of cows. He thought, you're somewhere different. This sure isn't Arcadia Beach anymore, Jacko. No, it wasn't Arcadia Beach. But he didn't know the area surrounding Arcadia Beach well enough to say for sure that he was more than 4 or 5 miles away. Just enough inland, say, to no longer be able to smell the Atlantic. He had come back as if waking from a nightmare. Was it not possible that was all it had been? The whole thing? From the carter with his load of fly-crawling meat to the living trees? A sort of waking nightmare in which sleepwalking had played a part? It made sense. His mother was dying, and now he thought he had known that for quite a while. The signs had been there, and his subconscious had drawn the correct conclusion, even while his conscious mind denied it. That would have contributed the correct atmosphere for an act of self-hypnosis. And that crazy wino, Speedy Parker, had gotten him in gear. Sure, it all hung together. Uncle Morgan would have loved it. Jack shivered and swallowed hard. The swallow hurt. Not the way a sore throat hurts, but the way an abused muscle hurts. He raised his left hand, the one not holding the bottle, and rubbed his palm gently against his throat. For a moment he looked absurdly like a woman checking for dewlaps or wrinkles. He found a welted abrasion just above his Adam's apple. It hadn't bled much, but it was almost too painful to touch. The root that had closed about his throat had done that. True, Jack whispered, looking out at the orange water, listening to the twank of the bullfrogs and the mooing distant cows. All true. Jack began walking up the slope of the field, setting the river and the east at his back. After he'd gone half a mile, the steady rub and shift of the pack against his throbbing back, the strokes Osmond had laid on were still there too, the shifting pack reminded him, triggered a memory. He had refused Speedy's enormous sandwich. But hadn't Speedy slipped the remains into his pack anyway, while Jack was examining the guitar pick? His stomach pounced on the idea. Jack unshipped the pack then and there, standing in a curdle of ground mist beneath the evening star. He unbuckled one of the flaps, and there was the sandwich. Not just a piece, or a half, but the whole thing, wrapped up in a sheet of newspaper. Jack's eyes filled with a warmth of tears, and he wished that Speedy were here so he could hug him. 10 minutes ago, you were calling him a crazy old wino. His face flamed at that, but his shame didn't stop him from gobbling the sandwich in half a dozen big bites. He rebuckled his pack and reshouldered it. He went on feeling better. With that whistling hole in his gut stopped up for the time being, Jack felt himself again. Not long after, lights twinkled up out of the growing darkness. A farmhouse. A dog began to bark, the heavy bark of a really big fellow, and Jack froze for a moment. Inside, he thought, or chained up, I hope. He bore to the right, and after a while the dog stopped barking. Keeping the lights of the farmhouse as a guide, Jack soon came out on a narrow blacktop road. He stood looking from right to left, having no idea which way to go. Well, folks, here's Jack Sawyer, halfway between Hoot and Holler, wet through to the skin and sneakers packed with mud. Way to go, Jack. The loneliness and homesickness rose in him again. Jack fought them off. He put a drop of spit on his left index finger, then spanked the drop sharply. The larger of the two halves flew off to the right, or so it seemed to Jack, and so he turned that way and began to walk. 40 minutes later, drooping with weariness and hungry again, which was somehow worse, he saw a gravel pit with a shed of some sort standing beyond a chained-off access road. Jack ducked under the chain and went to the shed. The door was padlocked shut, but he saw that the earth had eroded under one side of the small outbuilding. It was the work of a minute to remove his pack, wriggle under the shed's side, and then pull the pack in after him. The lock on the door actually made him feel safer. He looked around and saw that he was in with some very old tools. This place hadn't been used in a long time, apparently, and that suited Jack just fine. He stripped to the skin, not liking the feel of his clammy, muddy clothes. He felt the coin Captain Farron had given him in one of his pants pockets, resting there like a giant amid his little bit of more ordinary change. Jack took it out and saw that Farron's coin, with the Queen's head on one side and the winged lion on the other, had become a 1921 silver dollar. He looked fixedly at the profile of Lady Liberty on the cartwheel for some time, and then slipped it back into the pocket of his jeans. He rooted out fresh clothes, thinking he would put the dirty ones in his pack in the morning, they would be dry then, and perhaps clean them along the way, maybe in a laundromat, maybe just in a handy stream. While searching for socks, his hand encountered something slim and hard. Jack pulled it out and saw it was his toothbrush. At once, images of home and safety and rationality, all the things a toothbrush could represent, rose up and overwhelmed him. There was no way that he could beat these emotions down or turn them aside this time. A toothbrush was a thing meant to be seen in a well-lighted bathroom, a thing to be used with cotton pajamas on the body and warm slippers on the feet. It was nothing to come upon in the bottom of your knapsack in a cold, dark tool shed on the edge of a gravel pit in a deserted rural town whose name you did not even know. Loneliness raged through him. His realization of his outcast status was now complete. Jack began to cry. He did not weep hysterically or shriek as people do when they mask rage with tears. He cried in the steady sobs of one who has discovered just how alone he is, and is apt to remain for a long time yet. He cried because all safety and reason seemed to have departed from the world. Loneliness was here, a reality. But in this situation, insanity was also too much of a possibility. Jack fell asleep before the sobs had entirely run their course. He slept curled around his pack, naked except for clean underpants and socks. The tears had cut clean courses down his dirty cheeks, and he held his toothbrush loosely in one hand. Chapter 8 The Oatley Tunnel. 6 days later, Jack had climbed nearly all the way out of his despair. By the end of his first days on the road, he seemed to himself to have grown from childhood right through adolescence into adulthood, into competence. It was true that he had not returned to the territory since he had awakened on the western bank of the river, but he could rationalize that and the slower traveling it involved by telling himself that he was saving Speedy's juice for when he really needed it. And anyhow, hadn't Speedy told him to travel mainly on the roads in this world? Just following orders, pal. When the sun was up and the cars whirled by him 30-40 miles west and his stomach was full, the territory seemed unbelievably distant and dreamlike. They were like a movie he was beginning to forget, a temporary fantasy, Sometimes when Jack leaned back into the passenger seat of some school teacher's car and answered the usual questions about the story, he actually did forget. The territories left him, and he was again, or nearly so, the boy he had been at the start of the summer. Especially on the big state highways, when a ride dropped him off near the exit ramp, he usually saw the next car pulling off to the side 10 or 15 minutes after he stuck his thumb into the air. Now he was somewhere near Batavia, way over in the western part of New York State, walking backward down the breakdown lane of I-90, his thumb out again, working his way toward Buffalo. After Buffalo, he would start to swing south. It was a matter, Jack thought, of working out the best way to accomplish something, and then just doing it. Rand McNally and the story had gotten him this far. All he needed was enough luck to find a driver going all the way to Chicago, or Denver, or Los Angeles, if we're going to daydream about luck, Jackie baby. And he could be on his way home again before the middle of October. He was suntanned, he had $15 in his pocket from his last job, dishwasher at the Golden Spoon Diner in Auburn, and his muscles felt stretched and toughened. Though sometimes he wanted to cry, he had not given in to his tears since that first miserable night. He was in control. That was the difference. Now that he knew how to proceed, had worked it out so painstakingly, he was on top of what was happening to him. He thought he could see the end of his journey already, though it was so far ahead of him. If he traveled mainly in this world, as Speedy had told him, he could move as quickly as he had to and get back to New Hampshire with the talisman in plenty of time. It was going to work, and he was going to have many fewer problems than he had expected. That, at least, was what Jack Sawyer was imagining, as a dusty blue Ford Fairlane swerved off to the shoulder of the road and waited for him to run up to it, squinting into the lowering sun. 30 or 40 miles, he thought to himself. He pictured the page from Rand McNally he had studied that morning and decided, Oatley. It sounded dull, small, and safe. He was on his way, and nothing could hurt him now. Jack bent down and looked in the window before opening the Fairlane's door. Fat sample books and printed flyers lay messily over the back seat. Two oversized briefcases occupied the passenger seat. The slightly paunchy, black-haired man, who now seemed almost to be mimicking Jack's posture, bending over the wheel and peering through the open window at the boy, was a salesman. The jacket to his blue suit hung from the hook behind him, his tie was at half-mast, his sleeves were rolled. A salesman in his mid-30s, tooling comfortably through his territory. He would love to talk, like all salesmen. The man smiled at him and picked up first one of the outsized briefcases, hoisting it over the top of the seat and onto the litter of papers behind, then the other. "Let's create a little room," he said. Jack knew that the first thing the man would ask him was why he was not at school. He opened the door, said, "Hey, thanks," and climbed in. "Going far?" the salesman asked, checking the rearview mirror as he slid the gear lever down into drive and swung back out onto the road. "Oatley," Jack said. "I think it's about 30 miles. "You just flunked geography," the salesman said. "Oatley's more like 45 miles. He turned his head to look at Jack and surprised the boy by winking at him. "No offense," he said, "but I hate to see young kids hitching. That's why I always pick 'em up when I see 'em. At least I know they're safe with me, no touchy-feely, know what I mean? Too many crazies out there, kid. You read the papers? I mean, I'm talking carnivores. You could turn yourself into an endangered species." "I guess you're right," Jack said, "but I try to be pretty careful. You live somewhere back there, I take it?" The man was still looking at him, snatching little bird-like peeks ahead down the road, and Jack frantically searched his memory for the name of a town back down the road. "Palmyra. I'm from Palmyra." The salesman nodded, said, "Nice enough old place," and turned back to the highway. Jack relaxed back into the comfortable plush of the seat. Then the man finally said, "I guess you're not actually playing hooky, are you?" And it was time yet again for the story. He had told it so often, varying the names of the towns involved as he worked westward, that it had a slick, monologue-like feel in his mouth. "No, sir. It's just that I have to go over to Oatley to live with my Aunt Helen for a little while. Helen Vaughn, that's my mom's sister. She's a schoolteacher, My dad died last winter, see, and things have been pretty tough. Then, 2 weeks ago, my mom's cough got a lot worse, and she could hardly get up the stairs, and the doctor said she had to stay in bed for as long as she could, and she asked her sister if I could come stay with her for a while. Her being a teacher and all, I guess I'll be in Oatley School for sure. Aunt Helen wouldn't let any kid play hooky, you bet.
You mean your mother told you to hitchhike all the way from Palmyra to Oatley? The man asked.
Oh, no, not at all. She'd never do that. No, she gave me bus money, but I decided to save it. There won't be much money from home for a long time, I guess, and Aunt Helen doesn't really have any money. My mom would hate it if she knew I was thumbing it, but it seemed like a waste of money to me. I mean, $5 is $5, and why give it to a bus driver?
The man looked sideways at him.
How long do you think you'll be in Oatley?
Hard to say. I sure hope my mom gets well pretty soon.
Well, don't hitch back, okay?
We don't have a car anymore, Jack said, adding to the story. He was beginning to enjoy himself.
Can you believe it? They came out in the middle of the night and repossessed it, dirty cowards. They knew everybody would be asleep. They just came out in the middle of the night and stole the car right out of the garage. Mister, I would have fought for that car, and not so I could get a ride to my aunt's house. When my mom goes to the doctor, she has to walk all the way down the hill and then go about another 5 blocks just to get to the bus stop. They shouldn't be able to do that, should they? Just come in and steal your own car? As soon as we could, we were going to start making the payments again. I mean, wouldn't you call that stealing?
If it happened to me, I suppose I would, the man said.
Well, I hope your mother gets better in a hurry.
You and me both, Jack said with perfect honesty. And that held them until the signs for the Oatley exit began to appear.
The salesman pulled back into the breakdown lane just after the exit ramp, smiled again at Jack, and said, "Good luck, kid."
Jack nodded and opened the door.
"Well, I hope you don't have to spend too much time in Oatley anyhow."
Jack looked at him questioningly.
"Well, you know the place, don't you?"
"A little, not really."
"Ah, it's a real pit. Sort of place where they eat what they run over on the road, Gorillaville. You eat the beer and you drink the glass, like that."
"Thanks for the warning," Jack said and got out of the car.
The salesman waved and dropped the fare lane into drive. In moments, it was only a dark shape speeding toward the low orange sun. For a mile or so, the road took him through flat, dull countryside. Far off, Jack saw small, two-story frame houses perched on the edges of fields. The fields were brown and bare, and the houses were not farmhouses. Widely separated, the houses overlooking the desolate fields existed in a gray, moveless quiet, broken only by the whine of traffic moving along I-90. No cows lowed, no horses whinnied. There were no animals and no farm equipment. Outside one of the little houses squatted half a dozen junked and rusting cars. These were the houses of men who disliked their own species so thoroughly that even Oatley was too crowded for them. The empty fields gave them the moats they needed around their peeling frame castles. At length he came to a crossroads. It looked like a crossroads in a cartoon. Two narrow, empty roads bisecting each other in an absolute nowhere, then stretching on toward another kind of nowhere. Jack had begun to feel insecure about his sense of direction, and he adjusted the pack on his back and moved up toward the tall, rusted iron pipe supporting the black rectangles, themselves rusting, of the street names. Should he have turned left instead of right off the exit ramp? The sign pointing down the road, running parallel to the highway, read Dogtown Road.
Dogtown?
Jack looked down this road and saw only endless flatness, fields full of weeds, and the black streak of asphalt rolling on. His own particular streak of asphalt was called Mill Road, according to the sign. About a mile ahead, it slipped into a tunnel nearly overgrown by leaning trees and an oddly pubic mat of ivy. A white sign hung in the thickness of ivy, seemingly supported by it. The words were too small to be read. Jack put his right hand in his pocket and clutched the coin Captain Farron had given him. His stomach talked to him. He was going to need dinner soon, so he had to move off this spot and find a town where he could earn his meals. Mill Road it was. At least he could go far enough to see what was on the other side of the tunnel. Jack pushed himself toward it, and the dark opening in the bank of trees enlarged with every step. Cool and damp and smelling of brick dust and overturned earth, the tunnel seemed to take the boy in and then tighten down around him. For a moment, Jack feared that he was being led underground. No circle of light ahead showed the tunnel's end, but then realized that the asphalt floor was level. "Turn on lights," the sign outside the tunnel had read. Jack bumped into a brick wall and felt grainy powder crumble onto his hands. "Lights," he said to himself, wishing he had one to turn on. The tunnel must, he realized, bend somewhere along its length. He had cautiously, slowly, carefully walked straight into the wall, like a blind man with his hands extended. Jack groped his way along the wall. When the coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons did something like this, he usually wound up splashed across the front of a truck. Something rattled busily along the floor of the tunnel, and Jack froze. A rat, he thought. Maybe a rabbit out taking a shortcut between fields. But it had sounded bigger than that. He heard it again, farther away in the dark, and took another blind step forward. Ahead of him, just once, he heard an intake of breath, and stopped, wondering, was that an animal? Jack held his fingertips against the damp brick wall, waiting for the exhalation. It had not sounded like an animal. Certainly no rat or rabbit inhaled so deeply. He crept a few inches forward, almost unwilling to admit to himself that whatever was up there had frightened him. Jack froze again, hearing a quiet little sound, like a raspy chuckle, come out of the blackness before him. In the next second, a familiar but unidentifiable smell, coarse, strong, and musky, drifted toward him out of the tunnel. Jack looked back over his shoulder. The entrance was now only half visible, half obscured by the curve of the wall, a long way off and looking about the size of a rabbit hole. "What's in here?" he called out. "Hey! Anything in here with me? Anybody?" He thought he heard something whisper deeper into the tunnel. He was not in the territories, he reminded himself. At the worst, he might have startled some imbecilic dog who had come into the cool dark for a nap. In that case, he'd be saving its life by waking it up before a car came along. "Hey, dog!" he yelled. "Dog!" And was rewarded instantly by the sound of paws trotting through the tunnel. But were they going out or coming in? He could not tell, listening to the soft pad-pad-pad, whether the animal was leaving or approaching. Then it occurred to him that maybe the noise was coming toward him from behind, and he twisted his neck and looked back and saw that he had moved far enough along so that he could not see that entrance either. "Where are you, dog?" he said. Something scratched the ground only a foot or two behind him, and Jack jumped forward and struck his shoulder hard against the curve of the wall. He sensed a shape, dog-like perhaps, in the darkness. Jack stepped forward and was stopped short by a sense of dislocation so great that he imagined himself back in the territories. The tunnel was filled with that musky, acrid zoo odor, and whatever was coming toward him was not a dog. A gust of cold air, smelling of grease and alcohol, pushed toward him. He sensed that shape getting nearer. Only for an instant, he had a glimpse of a face hanging in the dark, glowing as if with its own sick and fading interior light, a long, bitter face that should have been almost youthful but was not. Sweat, grease, a stink of alcohol on the breath that came from it. Jack flattened himself against the wall, raising his fists, even as the face faded back into the dark. In the midst of his terror, he thought he heard footfalls softly, quickly covering the ground toward the tunnel's entrance, and turned his face from the square foot of darkness which had spoken to him to look back. Darkness. Silence. The tunnel was empty now. Jack squeezed his hands under his armpits and gently fell back against the brick, taking the blow on his knapsack. A moment later, he began to edge forward again. As soon as Jack was out of the tunnel, he turned around to face it. No sounds emerged, no weird creatures slunk toward him. He took three steps forward, peered in. And then his heart nearly stopped, because coming toward him were two huge orange eyes. They halved the distance between themselves and Jack in seconds. He could not move. His feet were past the ankles in asphalt. Finally, he managed to extend his hands, palm out, in the instinctive gesture of warding off. The eyes continued toward him, and a horn blasted. Seconds before the car burst out of the tunnel, revealing a red-faced man waving a fist, Jack threw himself out of the way.
"Shithead!"
came from the contorted mouth. Still dazed, Jack turned and watched the car speed downhill toward a village that had to be Oatley. Situated in a long depression in the land, Oatley spread itself out meagerly from two principal streets. One, the continuation of Mill Road, dipped past an immense and shabby building set in the midst of a vast parking lot, a factory, Jack thought, to become a strip of used car lots, sagging pennants, fast food franchises, the great tits of America, a bowling alley with a huge neon sign, Bowlerama, grocery stores, gas stations. Past all this, Mill Road became Oatley's five or six blocks of downtown, a strip of old two-story buildings before which cars were parked nose in. The other street was obviously the location of Oatley's most important houses, large frame buildings with porches and long, slanting lawns. Where these streets intersected stood a traffic light, winking its red eye in the late afternoon. Another light, perhaps eight blocks down, changed to green before a high, dingy, many-windowed building that looked like a mental hospital, and so was probably the high school. Fanning out from the two streets was a jumble of little houses interspersed with anonymous buildings fenced in behind tall wire mesh. Many of the windows in the factory were broken, and some of the windows in the strip of downtown had been boarded over. Heaps of garbage and fluttering papers littered the fenced-in concrete yards. Even the important houses seemed neglected, with their sagging porches and bleached-out paint jobs. These people would own the used car lots filled with unsaleable automobiles. For a moment, Jack considered turning his back on Oatley and making the hike to Dogtown, wherever that was. But that would mean walking through the Mill Road tunnel again. From down in the middle of the shopping district, a car horn blatted, and the sound unfurled toward Jack, full of an inexpressible loneliness and nostalgia. He could not relax until he was all the way to the gates of the factory, the Mill Road tunnel far up behind him. Nearly a third of the windows along the dirty brick facade had been broken in, and many of the others showed blank brown squares of cardboard. Even out on the road, Jack could smell machine oil, grease, smoldering fan belts, and clashing gears. He put his hands in his pockets and walked downhill as quickly as he could. Seen close up, the town was even more depressed than it had looked from the hill. The salesmen at the car lots leaned against the windows in their offices, too bored to come outside. Their pennants hung, tattered and joyless, the once optimistic signs propped along the cracked sidewalk fronting the rows of cars, one owner, fantastic buy, car of the week, had yellowed. The ink had feathered and run on some of the signs as if they had been left out in the rain. Very few people moved along the streets. As Jack went toward the center of town, he saw an old man with sunken cheeks and gray skin trying to wrestle an empty shopping cart up onto a curb. When he approached, the old man screeched something hostile and frightened and bared gums as black as a badger's. He thought Jack was going to steal his cart. "Sorry," Jack said, his heart pounding again. The old man was trying to hug the whole cumbersome body of the cart, protecting it, all the while showing those blackened gums to his enemy. "Sorry," Jack repeated, "I was just going to..." "Fushing thief! Fushing thief!" the old man screeched, and tears crawled into the wrinkles on his cheeks. Jack hurried off. 20 years before, during the '60s, Oatley must have prospered. The relative brightness of the strip of Mill Road leading out of town was the product of that era, when stocks went go-go and gas was still cheap, and nobody had heard the term discretionary income because they had plenty of it. People had sunk their money into franchise operations and little shops and, for a time, had, if not actually flourished, held their heads above the waves. This short series of blocks still had that superficial hopefulness. But only a few bored teenagers sat in the franchise restaurants, nursing medium Cokes, and in the plate-glass windows of too many of the little shops, placards as faded as those in the used car lots announced everything must go, closing sale. Jack saw no signs advertising for help, and kept on walking. Downtown Oatley showed the reality beneath the happy clown's colors left behind by the 60s. As Jack trudged along these blocks of baked-looking brick buildings, his pack grew heavier, his feet more tender. He would have walked to Dogtown after all if it were not for his feet and the necessity of going through the Mill Road tunnel again. Of course, there was no snarling man-wolf lurking in the dark there. He'd worked that out by now. No one could have spoken to him in the tunnel. The territories had shaken him. First the sight of the Queen, then that dead boy beneath the cart with half his face gone, then Morgan, the trees. But that was there, where such things could be, were perhaps even normal. Here, normality did not admit such gaudiness. He was before a long, dirty window, above which the flaking slogan Furniture Depository was barely legible on the brickwork. He put his hands to his eyes and stared in. A couch and a chair, each covered by a white sheet, sat 15 feet apart on a wide wooden floor. Jack moved farther down the block, wondering if he was going to have to beg for food. 4 men sat in a car before a boarded-up shop a little way down the block. It took Jack a moment to see that the car, an ancient black DeSoto that looked as though Broderick Crawford should come bustling out of it, had no tires. Taped to the windshield was a yellow 5x8 card which read Fair Weather Club. The men inside, two in front and two in back, were playing cards. Jack stepped up to the front passenger window. "Excuse me," he said, and the card player closest to him rolled a fishy gray eye toward him. "Do you know where Get Lost?" the man said. His voice sounded squashed and phlegmy, unfamiliar with speech. The face half-turned to Jack was deeply pitted with acne scars and oddly flattened out, as if someone had stepped on it when the man was an infant. "I just wondered if you knew somewhere I could get a couple days' work."
"Try Texas," said the man in the driver's seat,
and the pair in the back seat cracked up, spitting beer out over their hands of cards.
"I told you, kid, get lost," said the flat-faced, gray-eyed man closest to Jack, "or I'll personally pound the shit out of you."
It was just the truth, Jack understood. If he stayed there a moment longer, this man's rage would boil over, and he would get out of the car and beat him senseless. Then the man would get back in the car and open another beer. Cans of rolling rock covered the floor, the opened ones tipped every which way, the fresh ones linked by white plastic nooses. Jack stepped backward, and the fisheye rolled away from him. "Guess I'll try Texas after all," he said. He listened for the sound of the DeSoto's door creaking open as he walked away, but all he heard being opened was another rolling rock. Crack, hiss. He kept moving. He got to the end of the block and found himself looking across the town's other main street at a dying lawn filled with yellow weeds from which peeked fiberglass statues of Disney-like fawns. A shapeless old woman gripping a fly swatter stared at him from a porch swing. Jack turned away from her suspicious gaze and saw before him the last of the lifeless brick buildings on Mill Road. 3 concrete steps led up to a propped-open screen door. A long, dark window contained a glowing Budweiser sign, and a foot to the right of that, the painted legend, Updike's Oatley Tap. And several inches beneath that, handwritten on a yellow 5x8 card like the one on the DeSoto, were the miraculous words, Help Wanted. Jack pulled the knapsack off his back, bunched it under one arm, and went up the steps. For no more than an instant, moving from the tired sunlight into the darkness of the bar, he was reminded of stepping past the thick fringe of ivy into the Mill Road tunnel. Chapter 9. Jack in the Pitcher Plant. Not quite 60 hours later, a Jack Sawyer who was in a very different frame of mind from that of the Jack Sawyer who had ventured into the Oatley Tunnel on Wednesday was in the chilly storeroom of the Oatley Tap, hiding his pack behind the kegs of bush which sat in the room's far corner like aluminum bowling pins in a giant's alley. In less than 2 hours, when the tap finally shut down for the night, Jack meant to run away. That he should even think of it in such a fashion, not leaving, not moving on, but running away, showed how desperate he now believed his situation to be. I was six. Six. John B. Sawyer was six. Jackie was six. Six. This thought, apparently nonsensical, had fallen into his mind this evening and had begun to repeat there. He supposed it went a long way toward showing just how scared he was now, how certain he was that things were beginning to close in on him. He had no idea what the thought meant. It just circled and circled, like a wooden horse bolted to a carousel. Six, I was six. Jackie Sawyer was six. Over and over, round and round she goes. The storeroom shared a wall in common with the taproom itself, and tonight that wall was actually vibrating with noise. It throbbed like a drumhead. Until 20 minutes before, it had been Friday night, and both Oatley Textiles and Weaving and Dogtown Custom Rubber paid on Friday. Now the Oatley tap was full to the overflow point and passed. A big poster to the left of the bar read, "Occupancy by more than 220 persons is in violation of Genesee County Fire Code 331. Apparently Fire Code 331 was suspended on the weekends, because Jack guessed there were more than 300 people out there now, boogieing away to a country western band which called itself the Jenny Valley Boys. It was a terrible band, but they had a pedal steel guitar. "There's guys around here that'd fuck a pedal steel, Jack," Smokey had said. "Jack!" Laurie yelled over the wall of sound. Laurie was Smokey's woman. Jack still didn't know what her last name was. He could barely hear her over the juke, which was playing at full volume while the band was on break. All five of them were standing at the far end of the bar, Jack knew, tanking up on half-price Black Russians. She stuck her head through the storeroom door. Tired blonde hair, held back with childish white plastic barrettes, glittered in the overhead fluorescent. "Jack, if you don't run that keg out real quick, I guess you'll give your arm a try." "Okay," Jack said. "Tell him I'll be right there." He felt goose flesh on his arms, and it didn't come entirely from the storeroom's damp chill. Smokey Updike was no one to fool with. Smokey, who wore a succession of paper fry cook's hats on his narrow head. Smokey with his large, plastic, mail-order dentures, grisly and somehow funereal in their perfect evenness. Smokey with his violent brown eyes, the scleras an ancient, dirty yellow. Smokey Updike, who in some way still unknown to Jack, and who was all the more frightening for that, had somehow managed to take him prisoner. The jukebox fell temporarily silent, but the steady roar of the crowd actually seemed to go up a notch to make up for it. Some Lake Ontario cowboy raised his voice in a big drunken yee-haw. A woman screamed, a glass broke. Then the jukebox took off again, sounding a little like a Saturn rocket achieving escape velocity. "Sort of place where they eat what they run over on the road. Raw." Jack bent over one of the aluminum kegs and dragged it out about 3 feet, his mouth screwed down in a painful wince, sweat standing out on his forehead in spite of the air-conditioned chill, his back protesting. The keg gritted and squealed on the unadorned cement. He stopped, breathing hard, his ears ringing. He wheeled the hand truck over to the keg of bush, stood it up, then went around to the keg again. He managed to rock it up on its rim and walk it forward toward where the hand truck stood. As he was setting it down, he lost control of it. The big bar keg weighed only a few pounds less than Jack did himself. It landed hard on the foot of the hand truck, which had been padded with a remnant of carpet so as to soften just such landings. Jack tried to both steer it and get his hands out of the way in time. He was slow. The keg mashed his fingers against the back of the hand truck. There was an agonizing thud, and he somehow managed to get his throbbing, pulsing fingers out of there. Jack stuck all the fingers of his left hand in his mouth and sucked on them, tears standing in his eyes. Worse than jamming his fingers, he could hear the slow sigh of gases escaping through the breather cap on top of the keg. If Smokey hooked up the keg and it came out foamy, or worse yet, if he popped the cap and the beer went a gusher in his face... Best not to think of those things. Last night, Thursday night, when he tried to run Smokey out a keg, the keg had gone right over on its side. The breather cap had shot clear across the room. Beer foamed white gold across the storeroom floor and ran down the drain. Jack had stood there, sick and frozen, oblivious to Smokey's shouts. It wasn't Bush. It was Kingsland. Not beer, but ale. The Queen's Own. That was when Smokey hit him for the first time. A quick, looping blow that drove Jack into one of the storeroom's splintery walls. "There goes your pay for today," Smokey had said, "and you never want to do that again, Jack." What chilled Jack most about that phrase, "you never want to do that again," was what it assumed, that there would be lots of opportunities for him to do that again, as if Smokey Updike expected him to be here a long, long time. "Jack, hurry it up!" "Coming," Jack puffed. He pulled the hand truck across the room to the door, felt behind himself for the knob, turned it, and pushed the door open. He hit something large and soft and yielding.
"Christ, watch it!"
"Whoops, sorry," Jack said.
"I'll whoops you, asshole," the voice replied.
Jack waited until he heard heavy steps moving on down the hall outside the storeroom, and then tried the door again. The hall was narrow and painted a bilious green. It stank of shit and piss and tidy bowl. Holes had been punched through both plaster and lath here and there. Graffiti lurched and staggered everywhere, written by bored drunks waiting to use either pointers or setters. The largest of them all had been slashed across the green paint with a black magic marker, and it seemed to scream out all of Oatley's dull and objectless fury. "Send all American niggers and Jews to Iran," it read. The noise from the taproom was loud in the storeroom. Out here, it was a great wave of sound which seemed never to break. Jack took one glance back into the storeroom over the top of the keg tilted on the hand truck, trying to make sure his pack wasn't visible. He had to get out. Had to. The dead phone that had finally spoken, seeming to encase him in a capsule of dark ice, that had been bad. Randolph Scott was worse. The guy wasn't really Randolph Scott. He only looked the way Scott had looked in his 50s films. Smokey Updike was perhaps worse still, although Jack was no longer sure of that. Not since he had seen, or thought he had seen, the eyes of the man who looked like Randolph Scott change color. But that Oatley itself was worst of all. He was sure of that. Oatley, New York, deep in the heart of Jenny County, seemed now to be a horrible trap that had been laid for him. A kind of municipal pitcher plant. One of nature's real marvels, the pitcher plant, easy to get in, almost impossible to get out. A tall man with a great swinging gut porched in front of him stood waiting to use the men's room. He was rolling a plastic toothpick from one side of his mouth to the other and glaring at Jack. Jack supposed it was the big man's gut that he had hit with the door. "Asshole," the fat man repeated, and then the men's room door jerked open. A man strode out. For a heart-stopping moment, his eyes and Jack's eyes met. It was the man who looked like Randolph Scott. But this was no movie star. This was just an Oatley mill hand, drinking up his week's pay. Later on, he would leave in a half-paid-for door-sucker Mustang, or maybe on a three-quarters-paid-for motorcycle. A big old Harley with a Buy American sticker plastered on the nacelle, probably. His eyes turned yellow. "No, your imagination, Jack. Just your imagination. He's just a mill hand who was giving him the eye because he was new. He had probably gone to high school here in town, played football, knocked up a Catholic cheerleader and married her, and the cheerleader had gotten fat on chocolates and Stouffer's frozen dinners. Just another Oatley oaf. But his eyes turned yellow. Stop it, they did not!" Yet there was something about him that made Jack think of what had happened when he was coming into town, what had happened in the dark. The fat man who had called Jack an asshole shrank back from the rangy man in the Levi's and the clean white T-shirt. Randolph Scott started toward Jack. His big, veined hands swung at his sides. His eyes sparkled an icy blue, and then began to change, to moil and lighten. "Kid," he said, and Jack fled with clumsy haste, butting the swinging door open with his fanny, not caring who he hit. Noise pounced on him. Kenny Rogers was bellowing an enthusiastic redneck paean to someone named Reuben James. "Y'all has turned your other cheek," Kenny testified to this room of shuffling, sullen-faced drunks, "and said there's a better world waiting for the meek." Jack saw no one here who looked particularly meek. The Jenny Valley boys were trooping back onto the bandstand and picking up their instruments. All of them but the pedal steel player looked drunk and confused, perhaps not really sure of where they were. The pedal steel player only looked bored. To Jack's left, a woman was talking earnestly on the Taps payphone, a phone Jack would never touch again if he had his way about it, not for $1,000. As she talked, her drunken companion probed and felt inside her half-open cowboy shirt. On the big dance floor, perhaps 70 couples groped and shuffled, oblivious of the current song's bright up-tempo, simply squeezing and grinding, hands gripping buttocks, lips spit-sealed together, sweat running down cheeks and making large circles under the armpits. "Well, thank God," Lori said, and flipped up the hinged partition at the side of the bar for him. Smokey was halfway down the bar, filling up Gloria's tray with gin and tonics, vodka sours, and what seemed to be beer's only competition for the Oatly Town drink, Black Russians. Jack saw Randolph Scott come out through the swinging door. He glanced toward Jack, his blue eyes catching Jack's again at once. He nodded slightly, as if to say, "We'll talk. Yes, siree. Maybe we'll talk about what might or might not be in the Oatly Tunnel, or about bullwhips, or sick mothers. Maybe we'll talk about how you're going to be in Jenny County for a long, long time. Maybe until you're an old man crying over a shopping cart. What do you think, Jackie?" Jack shuddered. Randolph Scott smiled, as if he had seen the shudder, or felt it. Then he moved off into the crowd and the thick air. A moment later, Smokey's thin, powerful fingers bit into Jack's shoulder, hunting for the most painful place and, as always, finding it. They were educated, nerve-seeking fingers. "Jack, you just gotta move faster," Smokey said. His voice sounded almost sympathetic, but his fingers dug and moved and probed. His breath smelled of the pink Canada mints he sucked almost constantly. His mail-order false teeth clicked and clacked. Sometimes there was an obscene slurping as they slipped a little and he sucked them back into place. "You got to move faster or I'm going to have to light a fire under your ass. You understand what I'm saying?"
"Yeah,"
Jack said, trying not to moan. "All right, that's good then." For an excruciating second, Smokey's fingers dug even deeper, grinding with a bitter enthusiasm at the neat little nest of nerves there. Jack did moan. That was good enough for Smokey. He let up. "Help me hook this keg up, Jack, and let's make it fast. Friday night people got a drink."
"Saturday morning," Jack said stupidly.
"Then too. Come on." Jack somehow managed to help Smokey lift the keg into the square compartment under the bar. Smokey's thin, ropey muscles bulged and writhed under his Oatly Tap T-shirt. The paper fry cook's hat on his narrow weasel's head stayed in place, its leading edge almost touching his left eyebrow, an apparent defiance of gravity. Jack watched, holding his breath, as Smokey flicked off the red plastic breather cap on the keg. The keg breathed more gustily than it should have done, but it didn't foam. Jack let his breath out in a silent gust. Smokey spun the empty toward him.
"Get that back in the storeroom and then swamp out the bathroom. Remember what I told you this afternoon?"
Jack remembered. At 3 o'clock, a whistle like an air raid siren had gone off, almost making him jump out of his skin. Lori had laughed, had said, "Check out Jack, Smokey. I think he just went wee-wee in his tough skins." Smokey had given her a narrow, unsmiling look and motioned Jack over. Told Jack that was the payday whistle at the Oatly T&W. told Jack that a whistle very much like it was going off at Dogtown Rubber, a company that made beach toys, inflatable rubber dolls, and condoms with names like Ribs of Delight. Soon, he said, the Oatly tap would begin filling up. "And you and me and Lori and Gloria are going to move just as fast as lightning," Smokey said, "because when the eagle screams on Friday, we got to make up for what this place doesn't make every Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. When I tell you to run me out of keg, you want to have it out to me before I finish yelling. And you're in the men's room every half an hour with your mop. On Friday nights, a guy blows his groceries every 15 minutes or so." "I got the women's," Lori said, coming over. Her hair was thin, wavy gold, her complexion as white as a comic book vampire's. She either had a cold or a bad coke habit. She kept sniffing. Jack guessed it was a cold. He doubted if anyone in Oatly could afford a bad coke habit. "Women ain't as bad as men, though. Almost, but not quite." "Shut up, Lori." "Up yours," she said, and Smokey's hand flickered out like lightning. There was a crack, and suddenly the imprint of Smokey's palm was printed red on one of Lori's pallid cheeks like a child's tattoodle. She began to snivel, but Jack was sickened and bewildered to see an expression in her eyes that was almost happy. It was the look of a woman who believed such treatment was a sign of caring. "You just keep hustling and we'll have no problem," Smokey said. "Remember to move fast when I yell for you to run me out of keg, and remember to get in the men's can with your mop every half an hour and clean up the puke." And then he had told Smokey again that he wanted to leave, and Smokey had reiterated his false promise about Sunday afternoon. But what good did it do to think of that? There were louder screams now, and harsh caws of laughter, the crunch of a breaking chair and a wavering yell of pain. A fist fight, the third of the night, had broken out on the dance floor. Smokey uttered a curse and shoved past Jack. "Get rid of that keg," he said. Jack got the empty onto the dolly and trundled it back toward the swinging door, looking around uneasily for Randolph Scott as he went. He saw the man standing in the crowd that was watching the fight and relaxed a little. In the storeroom, he put the empty keg with the others by the loading bay. Updike's Oatly tap had already gone through 6 kegs tonight. That done, he checked his pack again. For one panicky moment, he thought it was gone, and his heart began to hammer in his chest. The magic juice was in there, and so was the territory's coin that had become a silver dollar in this world. He moved to the right, sweat now standing out on his forehead, and felt between 2 more kegs. There it was. He could trace the curve of Speedy's bottle through the green nylon of the pack. His heartbeat began to slow down, but he felt shaky and rubber-legged, the way you feel after a narrow escape. The men's toilet was a horror. Earlier in the evening, Jack might have vomited in sympathy, but now he actually seemed to be getting used to the stench, and that was somehow the worst thing of all. He drew hot water, dumped in Comet, and began to run his soapy mop back and forth through the unspeakable mess on the floor. His mind began to go back over the last couple of days, worrying at them the way an animal in a trap will worry at a limb that has been caught.